Advocate Mamiji Shai, I hope I'm pronouncing your name and surname correctly. Welcome to the interviews by the Ad Hoc Committee on the Appointment of a Public Protector. I hope you had a comfortable journey here and that Parliament has treated you well this afternoon. I've already made my apologies during tea break for delaying the entire process, so you'll pardon me once again. You have been nominated for the position of new public protector, is that correct?
Yes.
All right. I'm going to ask you one or two questions, and then the rest of the members will proceed. Let me first congratulate you for having made the top eight, if you like. You are one of eight candidates which the people that you are facing agreed that are the best candidates for the position. So congratulations for that. I will ask you one question, and that is, what is it that you believe qualifies you to be the best candidate for this position?
Okay. I will answer in three compartments. I'll answer around what I am today, what I have been, and how I got into the position, and also what I will be, meaning what will make me a public protector. At the present moment, I'm a deputy public protector. The period that I serve there is 3 and 7 months. I'm also trained as an ombudsman. So far, we know just one school that trains ombudsmen in London, and I went for training. I have also practiced as an attorney and advocate, and the cumulative period of that is how much? It is about 9 years, and I also it's 16 years. Sorry, from 1993. I'm sorry, 16 years, and during that time also, I was in public in a state organ. I served as a public defender and for 5 years, and I also worked in government as a chief legal advisor. I worked in two departments of government as a chief legal advisor, and as a chief legal advisor at the same time, I was a senior manager, and I was also in a strategic management of the two departments.
What period was that?
1993. In 2001, I joined the Department of Education as a chief legal advisor, called sometimes head of legal services. And then I moved, I was transferred to the National Department of Science and Technology in 2005. It was on the same year that I was appointed the Deputy Public Protector. The position of a public
protector... But what do you mean practice as an attorney or as an advocate? My understanding is that in the public service, only the state attorney or a state advocate would actually appear in court.
Yes.
And that all other legal advisors would actually be doing office work, if you like, or be office bound, as opposed to running from one court to the other, so to speak.
In 1993, when I was a public defenders was one of the institutions that were created while the first constitution was being written in 1992, and it was one of the institutions that were going to realize human rights, and it was instituted basically for the defense of indigenous people that were very poor to afford legal services. And it was more focused on people that were facing long imprisonment or that were facing capital punishment during that time. My job was appearing in court arguing cases, so we were defending these people. I was
I remember that.
And that was practicing. And we were focused on making this pilot project permanent. In 1998, when it became permanent, that's when I left to open my own firm, which was called Mamiki Shaya Tennis in Johannesburg. And I continued to practice there from 98 to 2001 as an attorney. But in 1996, that is prior to opening my own firm, I had already been appearing in the High Court. And in 2001, I joined the Department of Education.
To me, it would amount to a totality of 93 to 2001. That would be about 8 years of actually practicing. I'm just following on the earlier comment that you made, that you have a cumulative period of 16 years in practice. I would, in my opinion, say it's actually half of that period that you've actually been in practice. Would you disagree with me?
Because practice, the interpretation, I think, is an argument about the interpretation. What is practice? For me, it is practice. But however, it's, if you mean...
Put it this way, the Act distinguishes between different qualifying criteria.
Yes.
The one is that of having been a judge. The other one is that of having practiced as an attorney or as an advocate. And then the third one has to do with experience in public administration. I think that from 2001, your experience would be relating to the third category as opposed to the second category. You may want to disagree, and you're entitled to that, but that would be my reading of the Act in making the specific distinction.
Okay.
And of course the other one is academic experience. Of course there's nothing, the Act says that you could have one or more of those, and it is the totality of the cumulative period. So it's not as if this takes anything away from you. I'm merely trying to say, based on my understanding of the Act, you in fact have 8 years of practice plus the balance of the years of experience in public administration.
Okay. Yes, I would agree. My 2001 would have been the first time when I, and if we exclude the public defender as a state organ or public administration, then my from 2001, that's when...
Well, I would say you practiced even when you were a public defender, because
yes,
you were doing court work. Even if you were an attorney, a state attorney or a state advocate, I would still say you practiced during that period.
Yes, I was just saying that it would mean that from 2001, when I entered public administration, that would give an extra period from 2001 to 2005. I was on the question of what I'm doing and who I am. As a deputy public protector, I function through the delegation of the public protector in terms of the Act. And when I joined the office, there was no division between government and administration. It means that the office bearer would then handle matters of governance, meaning to make it simple, it's matters around mandate and the functions of the public protector, and also handling the administration. So one of the greatest inputs I made that time was to ensure that there's this division, because I realized that more concentration was on administration, and to free the Park Protector and the deputy to develop the mandate and the functions. And as a result, I was delegated functions around the governance, while the Public Protector was managing administration. And we've been struggling so much to appoint a CEO. We had one, we lost one, and we are trying now. So the office was run in a totality in that way. And that gave me a chance as well to look at the mandate and the functions and to develop this, to set a new foundation. At the moment, we have just launched intake and early resolution. Early resolution is actually what that office should be doing, because what one could see is that there is a tendency of running the complaints as if it is a court case, something like that. So it is very cumbersome and it takes time. So to get to this mandate side, to develop this mandate is to elaborate on the strengthening democracy thing, because it's like the even the reports will not come to Parliament saying, here is my terms of reference, strengthening democracy, and this is the report. I have strengthened democracy. It will be a report showing efficiency, like I've achieved this. You know, the reports that are using the template of the Attorney General's office. So what my greatest inputs are at the moment is to elaborate on the mandate, to spell out what is strengthening democracy to compartments like looking at accountability of the state and transparency, rule of law, and also the effectiveness. In that way, then we are able to report properly as well. And also the functions.
Just before you leave that point, I just wanted to see if I understood you correctly. At one level, you're saying that the individual complaints, which would be more like your client type one-on-one issues, you seem to be saying that you want to put less emphasis on that and focus on the state as an institution and to what extent it meets the standards of democracy in terms of the criteria you listed. How do you achieve that without testing it against a specific complaint which is brought to you by a complainant in relation to one of those criteria in order to then be able to make an assessment, unless I misunderstood you completely in terms of the separation of those two elements?
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I think slightly you misunderstood. What I mean is that remember that the investigating of complaints is actually not the role of the Park Protector. It's actually a mechanism of how we find evidence of, for instance, maladministration, the evidence that there's no accountability, evidence that there's no transparency, evidence that there is a deviation from the rule of law. Those are just symptomatic to me. So once we continue with an obsession to investigate, we lose sight of the main role of the Park Protector. The role is not spelled out in the Act. As far as I'm concerned, it should have been spelled out in the Act, especially because the Act was written during the early stages of constitutional dispensation. It should have been spelled out to say this is the role of the Park Protector and this is probably how. The machinery for identifying the deviations in accountability and so on, it's the investigation. But when you read the functions and reading the functions with the constitution, you can see, you can discern what the role of the Park Protector is, because the main role is not to find, probably when a complaint comes, it's not to find who's guilty or what, like court cases. It's just to determine the root cause of this deviation. And once you investigate and find that there is definitely a problem with accountability, it will inform the Public Protector to design a remedial action that is appropriate, because the remedial action as well has got to inform one of those few elements I have mentioned around democracy. It should say at least that it should inform issues of probably transparency if that maladministration, mismanagement, or abuse of power answers to that. But what I'm saying is that the Act, as it is at the moment, has got different provisions that were not fully developed. And if we focus much on the mandate, we are able to develop those provisions optimally, because at the moment it's the first time we have produced the first version of the guidelines, which the Act was saying that we should produce guidelines, we should produce forms, we should produce procedures. Those we never had. And that is what I did when I came there, to say, let's look at the Act and one by one, provision by provision, develop what was not developed before. And the other thing is that what was not developed as well was using alternative dispute resolution to reconcile. Remember that if we have a complaint, the aim also is to reconcile, promote the confidence that the public should have on the state. So if we use alternative dispute resolution, what is excluded there is just arbitration, but we would be able to reconcile the two, so that the public has got confidence in its government and are able to make input on government services. So the aim there is to make sure that we remove the perception that the public protector is defending the public or is defending the government, because both of them are just public to us.
In terms of it having an end result of satisfying the parties, I have difficulty with the earlier construct of your construct of the role of a public protector, which seems to lean more on the medium to long term structural flaws that you want to then remedy, as opposed to dealing with and resolving the problem of this specific individual who has been running from one office to the other and been sent from pillar to post, is unhappy about government, thinks that government just doesn't help, and I've now gone to the public protector thinking that this should be the ultimate office that resolves my problem. And there goes the public protector, giving him this broad, broad framework of promoting democracy. To him, democracy is about his problem being resolved. Can I just specifically refer to the fact which came earlier, and that is the fact that the public protector cannot litigate, unlike the Human Rights Commission. Do you see that as a necessary limitation in your own opinion, or do you believe that poses a particular constraint, and that in part explains why you can't really focus on resolving individual disputes with the state, but rather focus on using those disputes to identify if there are flaws in the way government functions in connection with promoting democracy and remedying that?
I think I'm faced with two questions. The one was about the issue of resolving complaints that are coming to the office. And then the second one will be about the enforcement powers that the public protector has. The first one, my explanation was trying to reach a point where I'm saying that's why I mentioned the early resolution unit that we are open. The reason of a early resolution unit is exactly to deal with complaints promptly, because if you take a case and you want to handle it, in the way that we handle a court case. It might take 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. That is why if you look at our report, we have a lot of complaints that we are taking over to the next year all the time. And in that case, public will lose confidence. But if we have a unit that where we can sift, for instance, we can sift the cases that are irrelevant and focus on cases that are authentic, that are actually within the jurisdiction, and then deal with simple matters immediately so that those that are left are investigations that are cumbersome. Those are the ones that we will shift over to the old unit to complete and deal with. The early resolution intake, that is exactly what is aiming, to resolve complaints and to resolve them immediately, promptly, without a waste of time. And that is the unit that we have established starting from now in September. We are hoping that it will. And this is the unit where we are going to do dispute alternative dispute resolution and all those things. That's the unit where you'll find that just calling people in a meeting in one day resolves the matter. So we will be able to sift what cases can we put for investigations, and then what cases can be resolved immediately. Can I carry on with the second question? The second question is about enforcement powers. I really tend to agree that the public protector should remain as it is around making recommendations and remedial action, because the power of the public protector rests so much around her power. I will use her a power of persuasion and being scrupulous, because. If the public protector's recommendations will also be informed by a lot of things, those requirements that are set for the public protector, the requirements of independence, the requirements of integrity, impartiality, and so on, those will give effect to the recommendations of the public protector. If the public protector is completely, totally independent, if he's got integrity, if it's impartial and it's known to be there, the public will start to gain confidence. And even when the recommendation comes, they will start to believe that it is made from an objective mind, and therefore they can agree to that. And so far, Aspit Mushwana was mentioning just one case where there has been resistance, and we were talking to the department concerned about it, but all the recommendations have been accepted that were issued to departments.
Convinced that the system as it stands works quite effectively in achieving the underlying constitutional objective of the underlying the establishment of the office.
Yes, but with a reservation which I really must mention. The constitution as it is gives effect to the concept of the public protector. It protects the independence, the integrity, and so on. It also states clearly that there shouldn't be any interference from any body, any state organ or whatsoever. And then there is a provision in subsection 3 that talks about assisting the Office of the Public Protector. But people are reading it wrong to mean that they must come and assist us. But when you read it with this other provision around non-interference, it only means that they must make way for the public protector to be independent. It's qualified to be independent, to have integrity, and so on. But then there's a problem. While we have a constitution that is good, that is supporting this concept of the public protector, then we have a Public Protector Act that is totally in contradiction with the constitution around those aspects of independence. And independence is closely linked with integrity. The Public Protector Act, with due respect and with a lot of apologies, it's an appalling act. It's horrible. It's a bad act. It has to be repealed. It causes a lot of confusion around how the public protector should now relate to the state organs. it gives a power to the Minister of Justice and also Minister of Finance. It causes this dependency between the public protector and the state organ. It is also inconsistent in the way in which it has set out issues around terms of reference for the deputy and the public protector. It causes a lot of problems. It's also not user-friendly. It's not reader-friendly. It's an act that has to be repealed or has to be amended to make it consistent with the Constitution.
I'm going to allow other colleagues the opportunity to ask questions. I have, again, Ms. Michael, and then followed by Mr. Spagnoni. And then I'll come back to is that Mr. Ndaweni? Or Ndabani, sorry.
Ndapane.
All right. Sorry about that. All right. Let's start with Ms. Michael. Honorable Michael.
Thank you very much, Chair. I've been very outspoken on what I feel was successes, but mostly shortcomings of the last term of the Public Protector. I have levelled much criticism against the Office of the Public Protector, being someone who used to work in local government and handed a lot of issues over to the Public Protector, which I felt were not dealt with fast enough and in the correct manner. Now, the one issue that I applauded this last term of the Public Protector was the amount of cases that went through the office and were handled, and I think it was a record amount of cases that were handled. But I do think that due to the kind of appointment made, there was scope for political parties to call political interference in the office of the Public Protector. I would like to know from you, if you were to be made the Public Protector, what would you have done? What would you have done differently? Yes, of course. No, of course.
Pause to allow her.
Okay, so let me say that again.
Proceed from
there. Yeah. All right. So the first part of my question would be, what would you have done differently if you were the Public Protector? And if you are successful, what will you do to improve the reputation of the Public Protector?
The first question is around independence, isn't it? I will just give a brief background on what the independence of the Public Protector should be in terms of how I understand. The person of the Public Protector should have the three sets I will mention. It's institutional independence, it's functional independence, and it's personal independence. The first one, the institutional one, means that this institution must work totally. It's a total independence where the Public Protector, the institution, is neutral. It means that it cannot be part of the state. The functional one as well, that deals with operations as well. It has to deal with the budget. If the Public Protector has got a budget which is not controlled by any institution, that will give effect to this functional one. And to jump to the personal one, that is a person who must be neutral, non-partisan, meaning that this person should not be a member of any political party, any visible institution that has got influence around it. And what is happening at the moment, I just want to deal with the functional end so that we remain with the personal one. The functional one and the institutional one, as far as I'm concerned, there is no independence. If you practically see how we work, the Public Protector has got to go to Department of Justice to say that this is my objectives and I would like to have money. The Department of Justice represent the public protector when it comes to the budget. We are within the vote of justice. And in that way, even when the arguments are made about our budget, they are made on our behalf, the feelings and the passion that comes with it is not there. So that is one area that steals the independence. And the second one, it's related to that, is that because of the control, the monetary control, every report, every strategic plan whatsoever has got to pass through the hands of some officials in Treasury who tell us to comply to their templates. The templates are not explaining effectiveness of the PAC protector. It only explains the efficiency. If you look at the templates that say, these are my targets, achieve, not achieve, achieve, no. For me, it's very difficult to even come to Parliament and represent them. For me, I always say to them, this is an annex. It says nothing. It doesn't talk about how effective we are around issues of democracy. So this has also...
Which template are you referring to?
In every institution, there would be strategic planning which translates to the mandate of the institution into...
But who determines
it? It's supposed to be determined by us, by the PAC protector, but we get instructions that it must comply with the Treasury format. And that is, for me, it's something for me that is arguable.
Is this for purposes of funding?
Yes,
the budget,
I know.
Or would you say it goes beyond that?
It is. I think it's the budget because of funding. You know, we know the truth is that the person who's got the money has got the control. That is just the truth. If I have money, I'll design and give instructions and end up. Even the consultative process is not my consultative process. It's a request for approval, and that takes away the independence of the PAC protector. That is why I would like to emphasize it here that part of the reputation that the PAC protector has lost was caused by this problem of funding, which we have to resolve. Otherwise, every public protector will be bad in the eyes of the public because...
But this is a separate question. The question relates, which arises from your comment, actually. You are saying that the template that define the reporting lines, if you like, the heads under which you are expected to report are limiting in the sense that it does not go so far as to assess impact. It simply assesses efficiency in the utilization of resources. Now, I'm trying to understand to what extent could that be seen as limiting. Because isn't it so anyway that whoever is the Minister of Finance would primarily be interested in the efficient utilization of resources. The reporting to Parliament, I wouldn't imagine you confining yourself in your report there to showing us how efficient you've used the resources, but actually putting more emphasis on whether you set specific targets for yourself and whether you have in fact reached them, or generally how effective you have been in making a difference in relation to your own mandate. So I wouldn't see any contradiction there necessarily, unless you're saying that the reporting to Treasury actually compels you to report in a particular way, even when it comes to Parliament. Unless I didn't understand your assertion about the constraint.
Okay. I like the question, the phrase where you separate effectiveness and efficiency. That is exactly.
Actually, came from you.
Yeah, fine. But I was trying to show how where legislation itself. Remember that the PAC protector is subject to the constitution and the law. The law, as I have explained, as far as I understand the constitution, that law doesn't sufficiently provide for the independence because it has put us first of all, under the vote of the Department of Justice. And I repeat again that if I have money, I can control the whole world.
That is a general complaint even from the judges. Yes. The judges will always tell you exactly that. But that is more an institutional issue that may need to be dealt with it at another level. You're entitled, of course, to join the number of the many number of institutions that have made that complaint.
Yeah. But of course I'm also entitled to make inputs around the repeal of this legislation,
But I'm more interested, I think we're more interested in the point about you as the public protector, who in our view define for yourself what your targets are, and within the constraint of the resources that you get, go out and discharge that mandate and then report to Parliament. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm saying, I don't see why in your reporting to Parliament you shouldn't be able to report on the actual effectiveness. And I don't see how those other constraints should limit you. Yes.
Chair, I see where you're going with this, but you must remember I asked a very difficult question to Advocate Shah. I asked her in the first place what she would have done differently, and in the second place, I asked her what she would do to improve the reputation. And I think that we must give Advocate Shah a fair chance to explain to me and to explain to this committee what she would do differently, because she's explained to us that in her opinion, one of the greatest setbacks was the fact that the funding created a non-level playing field for their independence. So we understand that now, but I think we must give Advocate Shah the chance to tell us what she would change to make her a better public protector.
Precisely what my follow-up question is trying to elucidate from her, to say we understand the constraints, the institutional constraints. But going back to the institution itself, how far can it go within the constraints to actually achieve the effectiveness?
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you. I don't want to lose my answer to your questions around independence. What is it that I would do differently? In 2006, I did make a submission to the ad hoc committee that was dealing with a review of Chapter 9. I wrote something like 21 pages explaining in details what the mandate means, and I focused on integrity and independence. And when I read the report, I see that my recommendations were accepted. And that is one area that I thought I must do to at least influence those who interpret the law. This issue around independence, I think I will leave that one around institution and functional. It is clear that it's because of the budget where we don't have control that we are not able to proudly say we are independent. What I will do differently around that, first thing is just to ensure that this law is appealed. I will make a very strong input around the repeal of this law. I have been writing laws. I'll write it myself as an input, but I will propose that it is consistent with the Constitution. The second point is about the reputation. The reputation, I just want to give a little background because it might help to understand. In South Africa, and for instance with the English law, it's a common law country. The interpretation of the law, it's restrictive. That is what we learned from the university, restrictive interpretation, literal interpretation. And with the coming of the Constitution, a lot of practitioners could not leave this, they're still bound to this restrictive interpretation. The Constitution has got the underlying principles. To summarize it, it's good faith, but it's justice, it's equity. In South African context, it's redress, it's equality, it's human dignity. All this underlying principles that every lawyer should interpret the law, take into account those. That will give effect to the mandate, because if we interpret the law restrictively like that, we are not going to meet the demands of democracy, because even these values that I have mentioned, these are the values that are coming along with the democracy. I will be able to add so much value around expanding on that and interpreting on that. At the moment, I have just passed the coursework in my master's and my thesis that I'm putting forward. It's around the interpretation. My influence is around extensive and liberal interpretation of not only the law, the conduct, making decisions, all those things. And this is a greatest input I will make with this, because I forgive practitioners in South Africa, because we know that this is also made worse by the obsession with the precedent system, because we were taught that way from the university, that the law is to be interpreted literally this way and that way. And we have a precedent system that people always want to refer to what did the judge do in this case, instead of being creative to say, I have a basis, because there is a constitution that supports me if I interpret this way. So that is the interpretation aspect that I will also bring there. The other thing, I have been a citizen. I have been a scholar for all my life since I was at the university, a scholar of law. And I have known to be an independent thinker, and I have known never to submit any submission. So that helps me a lot. I have a confidence that I know, because in all areas where I worked, even as a legal advisor, you'd have people trying to sway you to all directions. And I know very well there is not even one person who can even contact me to come and whisper about the complaint to say, do this, do that. Because people go to people they know that they are able to sway. But with me, it is never going to happen. And that I can promise. That is the other thing. You know, with our institution, the interpretation of an office bearer obviously affects the interpretation of other lawyers who are assisting the office bearer, because this is his accountability. He will interpret in the way that he interprets. And the other aspect I want to mention is our budget, as I speak, because of this control, cutting of the budget. The operational budget is ridiculously at 33%, whereas the personnel budget is 66%. You can see the problem there already, that we will end up just paying salaries and have nothing to work with. So this forces us to start creating systems that will be cost-effective, not moving physically, but moving psychologically from an obsession around quantitative production and to look at quality production, because this will help. Because if we have a case that is done properly with the mandate that is elaborated clearly, the result will be clear and the impact will be visible. Rather, we focus on the impact that is visible, but at the same time making sure that our people get the service that we did. The one thing that I did, when you say what will you do, a lot of things I have done. As I say that I was more on the governance side while the Public Protector was sorting out administration. One of the things that I had proposed there that we have done, I think we adopted last year, was a service charter of the Public Protector, where we put values, especially ethical values and all other values, and where we guide our investigators to comply with. That also helps. The other thing was rationalizing all the policies that we have. We didn't have a lot of policies, so we added. One of the best ones that we did was to link performance, salaries with performance, and we are already implementing it, to link the bonus in maybe 2 years, nobody will get bonus if the institution is not performing. So what we did was to create a three-legged bonus system where we give bonus if the institution has performed. If it has performed, we go to the teams and then we go to the individuals. So in about 3 years, nobody might get a bonus. So that culture, it's already, we have implemented this performance system that is new, and I think you'll see this office working. The other thing was the office was not automated, so even the statistics were done manually. So we have now installed a case management system, which will also help a lot with statistics. The other one that will enhance the reputation, I did find that the Park Protector had also beautiful systems that are recommendable. One of them was a file inspection where he does a self-evaluation. The problem was only a lack of sufficient resources. But when he gave it to me, I was able to develop it. And the file inspection, it's meant to self-evaluate. It's about a matter of integrity. If we say to Parliament, this is what we have done, in most cases we would be relying on data that we get from managers. But now we go straight to the places at random, take this and that and record to verify. And at that stage, we are also coaching and mentoring our representatives in provinces to ensure that. So with this file inspection, we are also doing auditing and things like that. The other important one that I will mention in this area of reputation, we have a quality assurance committee, a team, where every report that comes, it's only those that the Park Protector has classified under special investigation, but generally, all reports that are issued are seen by all investigators. They are able to make inputs, and then they are able to criticize them, and then we are able to transform and teach, educate, and coach during that time of that committee. So with the reputation, what we did as well, we didn't have a lot of policies. One of the strategies that we adopted is a comprehensive communication strategy, which included media relation, improvement of media relation. If you would realize, in the past, we didn't have this calling the media so that we give them reports. So now we have a formal organized media briefings that we are doing, and we're involving media as well to communicate also the successes. We know we are still struggling to get those across, but we are informing the media about all the complaints that we are dealing with, and then giving positive stories of our success. And the last thing, we used to have a special investigations where these cases, some of them high profile cases, used to be dealt with separately. But I did propose a joining of the, that was just to make a structure very lean. So we joined we don't have divisions like special and this and that, we have just investigation unit, and that helps a lot to transfer skills as well.
Honorable Michael, are you satisfied with the... All right. Thank you. Honorable Spagnoni, you and I.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yourself and myself were trained by Chief Justice Paslanga how to conduct interviews. In case you know a person, you start by declaring how you know that person. I would like to declare that I happen to know Advocate Shai. For Comrade, for Honorable George, I was the chairperson of the ad hoc committee for the appointment of the Deputy Public Protector when she was successful in that ad hoc committee. But you sounded during that interview as someone who's got brilliant ideas, who would bring some change in the Office of the Public Protector. In brief, would you say your intentions were realized during this period when you were working as a deputy public protector in that office? I remember you were making an example of am I correct to say, jelly?
I don't remember.
Okay. what would you say about the period you have served there in the office of the public protector?
You know, there are good things and there were obstructions, of course. I do not want to dwell into that, but there were obstructions that in the beginning of my term there, there was confusion about my role as a deputy because of the terms of reference, which are horrible as well. They put me under the public service, and I think the public protector had a problem of understanding, am I appointed as a manager or as his deputy in the true sense of the word? So the delegations I got were taking me very far from my position. And it was a long struggle about delegations. And that is a fact, that it was an obstruction. Right now, at this stage, I still have not been delegated powers. The only way I succeeded was that I work almost like a consultant for the public protector, advising him. That's how I got my input across. It's just to write. I research a lot, and then I interpret and I write. Then I say, this is my recommendation. Fortunately, he liked a lot of around the mandate. That's where I couldn't get through. And then it's only now in September that he agreed that, yes, Advocate, you, I think you are interpreting it correctly, and I think we should take your input and start to work on it. But that was the greatest challenge for me was that I couldn't get delegations, especially delegations of powers, because whatever function you do, if you don't have the authority to go with it, it's just useless. So I was just working so much like a consultant. In most cases, because there has been a lot of responsibilities, especially with the African Ombudsman Association. I get a chance there where the PAD protector is away, then I represent him, I represent the PAD protector, especially in outreach, because I'm also very passionate about outreach. That's where we teach. Because teaching is my second nature. I love it. So when I do outreach, accessing the communities, I enjoy it, and then I've done a lot. I think I've done so much there to an extent that at this stage we were at a position where we are designing a strategy. The draft is there, but I don't even remember very well. We call it a 44 million. We're trying to reach out to just everybody. If you remember, for the past 3 years, we started to do mobile offices. We have mobile offices. We are trying by all means to reach every area there is, even where there is no light. I've been to an area where there is no light, where there is no water, where my car had to be stopped there, then I have to walk to the hall to go and make a presentation. And we have a lot of support from traditional leaders and municipalities. But we have developed that area together of accessibility with the ideas of everyone. I can't say we are almost there, the resources. We would need resources, but the intention and the strategies are there and the efforts are there, and we can see where we are going with that. So I remember very well the statement that was quoted was about leadership and transformational leadership. It was spaghetti, not jelly. So even though I'm managing, because sometimes I do chair meetings with the public protector. When I chair, that's when the managers get the benefit of who I am, and I can see the change because people start to talk when I'm chairing. They talk a lot when I'm chairing, because I would give them that opportunity to challenge whatever it is that we put on the table, to think independently and to I always ask them for input. So the spaghetti story was about leadership, because I don't really agree. That is why I was saying to Honorable Michael that one of the things we are doing is to make the institution leaner. I didn't elaborate, but one of the reasons is to destroy this top-down structure where people don't develop. You find five people, this last one is reporting indirectly to this one, and the four of them are just chief directors of something, very big people, but they have nobody to chief direct, they have nobody to direct. So we find those situations, and they exist not only in our office. They exist in a lot of government departments. But if we can work on destroying that top-down structure, we don't have a lot of foot soldiers there, and then we need foot soldiers, because if we have all managers, there's nobody doing the spade work, and then the park protector himself or the deputy end up doing the spade work. So that is one focus area that I'm silent about, but I'm busy with it. I've already, all the vacant management positions, the evaluation, the intention is never to fill them unless if it is really, really necessary to take that post and then distribute it to foot soldiers, because we really need people that can work. The institution is very small. It has got 256 staff components. It is not difficult to really have a few people on top who are necessarily there, and then have a lot of our investigators dealing with this complaint.
Can you tell us about the gender representation, now talking about top management people, chief directors and the like? What would be the percentage of the gender representation of the public protector?
I remember that we were a little bit low, with a few percent. I don't remember whether it's 3 or 5, but we are almost there. We've got a lot of managers that are female, but they still need a lot of training. But the park protector, there is women are developed there. The women have got positions there, but they still need a lot of training. The danger equation is almost around 49, somewhere there. We are almost there, because I remember the last time when we report to Parliament, we were so happy that we are close to 50% representation of female people.
Okay. Talking about the repeal of the legislation, it seems you want it to be thrown away. The Act speaks about people who will qualify, a person who has been a member of Parliament for at least 10 years, and obviously a person will not be a member of Parliament without being a member of a political party. Now, in your view, you are saying you envisage a person who is neutral, not partisan and the like. How do we achieve that?
You really help me with an answer, because when a person is a member of Parliament, that is why they say 10 years. Because by the time you are a member, we expect that you would have forgotten to be one-sided. Parliament represents the public. And for me, Parliament is safe. It's neutral for me. It doesn't matter who's got how much majority. But 10 years, I think 10 years qualifies that. It tells the story that this person was one-sided all along, but now for this 10 years, it's clean. It's been neutral. Although we know that members of Parliament are also members of political parties, it's a very tricky question for me. But if I had my way, if there were people that we call neutral, it's the same thing as talking about total independence. It is just not there, because we have checks and balances, all those things. But talking about a completely neutral person, is it possible to find a complete neutral person? If it is possible, then we have to set up requirements to say person who has never been a member of the police, which is not fair as well. Because people withdraw and say, this is the career I want to follow. And people know, I know, for instance, with me, you can never see me dancing with any member of the political party. You can never see me in a rally. Even if you can go to the videos, you'll never find me in a rally of any political party. Because I know I've got to be seen to be independent. I've got to be seen to be independent. If people see me around with the giants in political parties, they're going to suspect that I am not independent. So it's part of that integrity that we have to develop to say. It's a very tricky position because you have to decide, is this a life I will lead where I will think that I'm independent, act independent and say I'm independent, because people are going to watch you and are going to see you Saturday, Sunday in a movie with a very powerful person in a political party. Your independence is gone.
Question, are you perhaps not trying to suggest that a person who has an active role in a political party, that once they become appointed public protector, they should actually discontinue their active life within the political parties? Is that what perhaps you're trying to suggest? But that a person should not, by virtue of having been a member of a political party, be excluded from appointment. Would I be reading you wrongly?
Thank you very much. In my belief, if we say neutral and we say independent, we should say that. I can't talk about independence when the public is very sensitive. To them, I must also understand, in the view of the stakeholders, what is independence? I must also understand that. So as far as I'm concerned, a person has got to be neutral, has got to be known to be neutral.
Honorable Tsvanyane, you want to ask a further question?
Just the last question. Advocate Shai, what would you say is your community involvement? In other words, apart from having worked as a public defender, as a lawyer, and the like, what is that which you have busied yourself within the community before your career?
I have a social responsibility, and within this social responsibility, I'm mentoring lawyers from 1993. Because when I was a public defender, we were allowed to register 50 candidate attorneys. But due to resources, we were registering 22. Therefore, the 22 candidate attorneys, some of them, most of them, are still with me today. I've been mentoring them all along. When they go for any position, we would sit and I will guide them. When they study, I would guide them. Then I've got those that are sent by universities, people who know me, and then they would register with me for mentoring. I mentor them. The other thing I do is I do give a public lectures when called, especially around human rights issues. I've been in a debate when this country was considering euthanasia. A lot of Christian movements and Christian associations were very angry with it, you know, with abortion as well. And I represented a group of Doctors for Life around euthanasia debates when we were debating human rights and euthanasia. And during Women's Day, I'm always booked about 8 to 11 appointments during the time of Women's Day for Women's Day talks. And besides that, I also lead, we have an organization, it's called Friend of a Friend. It was established by professional Christian doctors. And I think for a period of about 12, 13 years, I was the only lawyer there. But we created an association where we can, the vision is actually to transform the society transformation. and also looking at ethics in profession. Initially, it was a bit self-centered because we were looking at ethics around our own practices. We were practitioners. But it has grown so much that we began to start to influence the community. Most of my members of these associations are having churches at the moment, but it came from those ideas, and then they are running churches where they can have a group of people to influence around ethics and around transformation. I think I'm a key role player there. I'm responsible also for youth integrity. It has taken me, in this country, I've been involved in anti-corruption forum, and then internationally as well, but internationally I was in the area where we deal with youth integrity and party political funding. Even at home here, I was part of the team that was dealing with party political funding. And then I'm also called by departments to talk about management, financial management, strategic planning, and then issues of administration. Most of my work is about motivational speaking as well. Then I also run a book review, a team already, it's not an old one, but we have already have people who have published books already. The aim is to encourage people to write. Then I also run the one for single people. The objective is also to turn them into being productive. And and then I also the public speaking sessions I have with the little ones where we try to boost their self-esteem. I do that.
Can I just indicate that we are running into time problems? So we may want to also in trying to engage. To try and summarize and be as brief as possible, we may have to make rearrangements with one of the candidates who has to leave tonight. But I don't want to limit members either in their quest to assess candidates. Any other member who wishes to ask questions? Yes, Mr. Wint.
Sorry. All right. I understood that you're referring to me. Unfortunately, you have covered my questions, even though they are not put to you in the manner I formulated them. But if you feel you may just add something. The question is, as you have been deputizing the public protector, are you satisfied by the manner in which the office is run? Secondly, if you are not, what do you think it needs to be changed? Thirdly, and lastly, there is a perception that the public protector has not lived up to expectations. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, Mike, advocate. Did you also want to put questions?
Okay.
All right. If she's comfortable with that, yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, advocate, if there are people who are saying they've come to the wrong conclusion, how do you take it? Do you fight with them, or do you kill them, you shoot them, or whatever, you call them to the office and discipline them, whatever? I know that as a deputy, there are confidentiality in everything that you do. Or how do you protect that if anybody put a gun on your shoulder or somebody kiss you, whatever, or what doing whatever, because he wants some information, how do you protect that? because as a lawyer, you understand what my question is. The protection of confidentiality. How do you do that? Thank you very much.
Is there any other? Yes?
Just one question. You said the Public Protector Act. I'm not going to deal with other things that deal with independence, but my interest is that it's in conflict with the Constitution. My question is, how was that act? Normally, one of the requirements in making law is that no law must be made in this country which is in conflict with the Constitution. How was this act allowed to come into it?
Yeah. And maybe a further question there would be, in that vein, would there really be a serious problem? Because obviously the Constitution prevails. Where is the problem? Maybe let me leave it to you to answer. Yes, Madam Dini.
I think in follow-up to the very same question, if I heard you well, you said that you were part of the drafting committee.
She's saying she's a drafter herself and should be too happy to rewrite the whole law because she has the ability to do that.
She was not part of the initial constitution.
Okay. I think, is there any other member who wants to add another one to the list? All right. Please proceed. After you've answered these questions, if there is a member who strongly feels that there is a question that must be answered, I'm not going to limit them. All right?
The first one is very difficult. I wish I can skip it and come to it. The whether I'm satisfied with the way the office is run. They always say deliver DSM-PSQ. It's easy when you are outside to say you'll change this and do that and that, but the context might change your mind. The only area where I am not happy will be around the probably the mandate. I think our office is so focused on certain provisions of the Act. So I've already elaborated that we need to explore the other provisions and apply that Act optimally. So the dissatisfaction is around not applying this Act and also this Constitution optimally, and also not challenging the areas where the Act is an obstruction to us performing our mandate. The second one, where they say the Public Protector does not live up to his position or something like that, they are talking about his interpretation of the mandate. And I think it's also around the... Maybe to give an example, the case of Oilgate. With the jurisdiction of the Ombudsman, that is the Public Protector Office, you cannot take the recommendation to court for review because the recommendation is not a decision. But the jurisdiction, if there is a dispute around this jurisdiction, there is no way any public member can go, so the court is the appropriate forum to deal with it. So whether or not the Public Protector has not lived up to the expectation, it's difficult to answer with a no or a yes, because one has got to take the context, the environmental context, into account as well. If you look at the conditions under which the first Public Protector was working, it was just after the during the constitutional dispensation, where the interpretation was... A lot of people struggle with their interpretation. So before one can even effect the mandate, one has got to educate the public about their rights and so on. And with this current Public Protector as well, for little that I know and have experienced, is that the issues of the country as a whole, poverty, unemployment, or they do impact on us, because the minute when you go and address the communities with their language, in their language, when you finish, just when you stop and say questions, they ask you, when are you giving me a house? Do you understand what I mean? So the environmental context is not really a good platform for the public protector to operate. This has got to be dealt with, and then probably if we measure if one is successful, we have to be honest and we have to be fair, taking into account the environment as well. I always say that he has taken this office from one point to another where it is for some of us visible. We can see what he has done, even though I think he did his best, even if the best is not enough for the public. Where people, where we reach a wrong conclusion. A wrong conclusion in a court, we would say, is appealable. But if a recommendation, if a person doesn't agree with the recommendation, I will start by saying one expects the recommendation.
And maybe in the process, you just want to clarify to whom you make the recommendation. Because in the end, what happens after a recommendation has been made?
Let me just, if you don't mind, if I can rephrase this question. Let's say there is a complaint, and the complaint is against the Department of Housing about a house. And then we decided that the Department of Housing did not act, because we are not really acting like a judge where we find somebody guilty. We have to look at the root cause. We would say, yes, the department was not effective. Yeah? So it means that when we say that, the person that this recommendation favors will be the complainant. Yeah? Will be the complainant. But the department might be angry to say, no, why do you say we are not effective? What the public protector should do is to apply the rules of justice around fairness and explaining the rules of promotion of administrative justice that guides one to give reasons all the time. If we reach a recommendation like, I don't want to say conclusion, if we recommend, we make a conclusion like that, we have to give reasons. And the reasons have got to be substantiated by law. If my reasons are found in the law, I have to show. If they're found in the constitution or certain values, I have to show. If I don't show that, a person will have a problem with me. But as a public protector, if people are angry with your recommendation, I mean, one of the elements that is not put in that advert is emotional competency to run an office like that. One has got to be strong. If you know your story, if you know that you are right and you base your decision properly on law, you cannot get angry. What you do, you have to make people to understand. The other question was about confidentiality. Although we are not a state organ, we are not a government. This public protector is not a government department. We sometimes benchmark with certain policies if they make sense to us. There is a policy around, it's called MIS, Minimum Information Security. We do steal those ideas and apply them. Minimum Information Security System is called MIS. It's an acronym. I say that we borrowed those ideas and we are applying them. In the Public Protector's Office, the information that is physically in form is locked. The electronic ones is also locked. So we don't really have that problem unless we have a silly person, naughty people who take information deliberately out, but the security is very tight around information.
Is everybody satisfied with all the answers? All right.
The other question was...
just complete the question.
The other question was the question about the public protector being in conflict with the Constitution. Yes, it is true. true that the Constitution is supreme. That is why we will have confidence to show where the inconsistencies are, and I don't think anybody would argue to say it cannot be repealed. It is definitely inconsistent. And you asked the question, how I don't know who wrote the act, but I have established that it was written from the Department of Justice, and I also established that this act was actually a cut and paste from the old Ombudsman Act. I think it was the 1979 one.
Let's not go into the detail about the history of the act. I just want to answer one.
Because of that, it came with a spirit. That spirit of apartheid is there, of dominance and control. So it doesn't have the spirit of the Constitution, our Constitution.
Are there any other members who want to ask a question? I just wanted to indicate to you that obviously some of the concerns you raised fall outside of the purview or the mandate of this committee. This committee's mandate is very narrow, is to assess candidates and recommend the best candidate for appointment. But obviously, to the extent that the interview highlights certain binding constraints in institutional arrangements, in government, etc., that impact on the efficacy of your office, and I suspect many other offices in government, it is a matter that can be taken up at other levels. The Kada Asmal report was specifically aimed at reviewing matters such as that in relation to Chapter 9 institutions, for example. The Budget Committee is a platform, and so is the Justice Committee, in relation to some aspects that you touched on. All right. In conclusion, is there anything that you yourself would want to ask, or any final remark you would want to make very briefly to conclude this interview?
I'd just like to thank you, and that's all I can say. No questions.
Thank you very much, and we wish you luck. Travel safely. All right, can we get the next candidate who has flight difficulties? Allow you to stretch your legs after this one because she has problems with flight. All right. Yes.
Chair, I hope you didn't think I was rude when I...
I felt that her answer was irrelevant to your question. That's why I intervened. I mean, your question relates to herself and what she does, you know, not the ex. But it's fine. I mean, obviously, we'll take those things into consideration. Ms. Madonsela, welcome. Me and you, Honorable Svanyeni was saying earlier that we all need to declare any past acquaintances with candidates so that we are transparent ourselves as members of the committee, and I think I should lead in this regard and take the opportunity to say that at some point me and you have been at school together. And along the way, we have had interactions in one form or the other in our respective career paths whenever we encountered each other and so on. So we know each other quite well. But
welcome. And congratulate you to, for being one of the eight candidates without any one of the problems. I'm going to kick off by asking you a question, and that is to say, given your experience, your training, your character, your abilities, nature, etc., what is it that you believe makes you the best, the most suitable candidate for appointment as the new public prosecutor?
Thank you, Chairperson, and honorable members. Firstly, I want to thank you for the privilege to present myself as a candidate and for the fact that you have shared with us. What would I bring to the post of a public protector? It's partly my experience and partly my training and my passion in life. I will start with my training. I'm a lawyer. I have a BA law degree. I have an LLB degree from Berkeley. And in terms of my professional background, I have always been in the area of human rights. I started my career as a teacher. I mean, other than the preliminary jobs that I did, teacher, legal advisor, but my starting point was working in the trade union movement. At the time when there wasn't much pay, and the matter that drove us, those who were involved there, was really making a difference in people's lives. I started there in the early 80s in some union called National Union of Printers and Allied Labor. They didn't pay us at all there. All we did was just provide the services of time to give us fast money or train money and support them. It always gave me joy as a human being to make a difference to the workers that I was working with then. And I wasn't qualified as a lawyer when I started working with that union. I was just a volunteer. But over the years, I would represent them in the industrial court, industrial council. And then obviously when the nation got tough, we would then get a lawyer to represent them. From there, I took a post at the Center for Applied Legal Studies. Again, my attraction was the human rights element of this. I was involved in research around issues of gender, employment equity. I was into issues of local government. But the driving fact was always around how do you make a difference to human in the lives of fellow human beings. During those years, I also got involved in the civic movement, and I recall that every day in the morning, before I went to work, there were people coming home with housing disputes, and I had to help them resolve them through mediation and through legal advice. And coming back home again, it was similar issues, mostly around housing disputes. Over the years, I have then done a lot of research around human rights issues, around adverse social justice, around women's issues, children's issues, disabilities, etc. And I then joined government in 1995, invited by Minister Bala Omar to assist with the transformation of the justice system. And our role over those years was to look at the system and look at bridging the gap between what we inherited and what is the country and the people we're trying to build. And I was one of the also with Justice Vision 2000. Around the same time, I was involved in local government issues and the local government transition act. I was involved in employment equity. What I would say is my professional experience and my community work has prepared me for this post. And obviously, Mr. Chairperson, you then say that all of that is policy work. It hasn't given me the actual work around dealing with individual complaints. I would say I have dealt with individual complaints via the Center for Reconciliation and Equality Studies, which is a small NGO that we started. And soon it was taken by the South African Women Lawyers Association. And through the South African Women Lawyers Association, every day we're getting cases from civil society. On some of them are legal issues, but a lot of them are around administrative justice. This is an issue of an ID that I'm afraid that somebody has been looking for 4 years. I had one of the cases that I dealt with. The guy had a duplicate ID, and for 4 years, he has been working without success. And eventually, we got some solution for that. You get people who feel that their electricity has been switched off, but they've been paying, so there's been a miscommunication, and then you just pick up the phone and you help with the right people. I mean, just talking through the text and through the documents. Via the same South African Women Lawyers Association, we started a project that maybe honorable members have seen. It's called Access to Justice Week. And it has opened tremendous doors around what are people struggling with in terms of interfacing with government. And based on that, I feel that I could add value in the institution of the public protector by being more proactive. Some of the ways that I've been doing it, really going there and letting people know that this is what we do, this is what government owes you. Because part of the problem is people don't know what standards should they be expecting from government. And through the work that we've been doing by SAUNA and other institutions that have been involved in, that's the work that we've been doing, and that's the kind of experience that I would like to see in the public protection. For example, the Department of Public Service and Administration came up with Matibili and with charters for government departments. I was involved in doing one for the Department of Justice, right up to a point where we had a draft charter. But then when I left the department, it wasn't finalized. But instruments such as that make it easier for the citizen to know what are the standards that I should hold this public official to, and then what do I ask for. Those are some of the things that I've been dealing with. I've handled administrative justice matters. But I've also been a member of what is called a panel of high level disciplinary cases in the public service. And in those, you're trained to deal with complaints around a maladministration, corruption, and everything. I was also trained as an arbitrator. One of the people I co-arbitrated with at some stage was Judge Dennis Davis. Again, that's the level at which you don't just investigate, but you make a decision. I'm now a commissioner, a full-time commissioner in the South African Reform Commission. My work also prepared me to do similar work. We investigate matters that only can be put in the But for me, I think you need similar commitment to reconciling the behavior of public officials with the Constitution and promoting the rule of law.
A further question that, second question that I'll ask you is, and I noticed it in the interview today, that you are consistent in your gentle tone of speech. That seems to be a positive attribute that you seem to have maintained. yourself as having the necessary qualities overall that would enable you to work with people in a manner that would maintain the confidence of people that if they come to you as public protector, they will get help, they will be treated with that same tone of voice that you're displaying here, or is it something that only me knows that when you go out and actually become a different person? Is there anything that you would want to tell the committee that you feel might be a minor in considering you as a potential candidate, and if so, how do you explain yourself around that?
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Regarding my time, and I would say thank you for considering it as a positive attribute. Sometimes it is seen as a negative attribute because it will be somebody who can speak authoritatively. But I would say though that I have a particular nature, but at the same time I'm able to make decisions, send decisions, and I've been involved in various structures where I have to make those decisions, one of them being the commission itself. Regarding accessibility to the public, I am generally always accessible. As I've indicated, under the South African Women Lawyers Association, we do public awareness, and people have to approach the different people and to request assistance with their problems. And I'm always getting requests from the public for assistance. But in addition to just members of the public, I recall that for as long as I've been around, or for as long as I've had legal skills, the people I come across, they're all in front of the office. I mean, in the commission right now, your workers, the people that you find in the building, they always come over with problems, with assistance. Sometimes it's something as simple as one of the cases I had, for example, it was something as simple as the person the woman lives with had not been paid, a contractor hadn't paid. A person had not paid him, he was a contractor, had painted for someone, and he wasn't paid. So they said, okay, go to the commissioner. Ordinarily, the commissioner is the most senior person in the commission, so ordinarily, that's not the person you would go to go for your day-to-day program. But I do get that, and I'm able to assist. I think as a human being, if you've been placed in these spaces where we've been placed, I must disclose that I believe in God. And I think if you've been placed in these different spaces, there's a purpose, and your purpose is that where you can assist your justice, and never assist anyone, regardless of where that person comes from. But what does assistance mean? It still means operating within the law. It still means, I won't say to the person that you're right if you're wrong. I would advise them, and where necessary, I would pick up the phone and call the person. In this particular case, it was a colleague from a high-flying institution, a very senior person who hasn't paid the paper, and because he claimed the job wasn't done properly. But my view was he had done part of the job, so you can't just, you know, when the contract is not fulfilled, you then decide you will keep the paint work, you will keep, but then you will pay nothing for it. And the painter had actually got his own material. So I was able to negotiate with the colleague who I had never met. We discussed this matter telephonically, and in the end, she was able to do what she's supposed to pay, or at least to compromise and pay a certain amount, what places me in a position that this may be a disadvantage? I can't think of anything right now. I can say that other people say, because I'm in the South African Law Reform Commission, which is based in the executive, maybe I'm in government. But I would say no, it is an independent institution, which is established in terms of a statute of the South African Law Reform Act of 1973. And although our administration is done by the Department of Justice, but we work independently. Some of the members of the commission are even judges. So I would say that could be raised, but I don't think that should disqualify me as a local chair.
Let me leave the other questions that I have. I'll leave some handles to the other colleagues. I again say with Honorable Michael first, and then Honorable Sonia Nieta, and then I'll see the other committee, members later. Honorable Michael.
Thank you, Ken. Me and my colleague obviously have a trend in asking questions yesterday. I agree with you. You have a lovely tone of voice, and I hope you never change it, because you speak as someone who doesn't have to raise your voice, because it's obvious that you know what you're talking about, and that's a lovely attribute to have. So please don't ever change something to your great advantage. The public protector has had a very bad reputation in the past. I would like to know from you what you would do to uplift the reputation of the public protector.
Thank you, Honourable Member, and also thank you for the compliment. I think one of the things that I would do with improving the reputation of the public protector is getting people to know what is the public protector, and having community interactions between the public protector and communities. And I know that this has been done. I was looking at the report of the public protector over the last 10 years, that public awareness has been part of what they are trying to do. But my sense of it is that we still haven't reached the auntie in the township. They still don't know there's a public protector. The other day, I was told that the ladies on my street were saying that I'm busy fighting for the rights of prostitutes, and they don't have houses, they've been waiting for houses. So, and jokingly I say, but I'm not the public protector, because the public protector should be able to deal with those things. People should know that if I've been on the list since 1996 and nothing has happened, they should just know that there is a thing called the public protector. It's probably popularized it in terms of the language that people use, and people should be able to go there. You should be able to go in all hospitals, because that's where, again, maladministration happens, or the states happen. People should know that if things don't go right, there is a public protector. You need a sign everywhere you go with the public administration. You need a sign. The courts, for example, there's also one area where also the public protector has a role to play, and I've seen that they played a role in the labor court when it comes to delays. Obviously, the Act does not allow the public protector to get involved in judgment, and rightly so. But on matters of delays and court processes, I think the public protector should assist them. Another reason the protector has had a bad name has been a question of how do different people understand the role of the public protector. The public protector at the moment has immense powers, and those powers include not just collecting information from people, it also includes summoning people. It also includes conciliation and mediation and negotiation. So when I was reading some of the reports, I had a sense that it could be more. It could be more when there's a complaint than just asking the party concerned to submit information, and when that information is submitted, then the decision is that there is nothing further that we can do. Because sometimes the institutions concerned will give you the information that they want, but if you fix that, you will find information that will assist the complainant. Those are some of the things, but also just stakeholders to discuss with government. One of the things the public protector is supposed to do is to advise as well. And it also is supposed to take cases on its own. I mean, it can initiate issues on its own. We've had a burning country at the moment. Different people are angry. Service delivery people are angry. But the public protector is also sitting there in the country and has the same work problems are. I think with the people that I'm working with, we could go to communities on our own when we get these media things to find out what the issues are and arrest them on the ground. Not necessarily by blaming. I mean, at the end, obviously, there may be someone to blame, but I don't think we always solve problems in life by looking for who's to blame, who do we kill. Sometimes just by coming with a constructive solution and saying, what is this community struggling with, and who's supposed to provide the service, who's supposed to provide certain answers, and working with those people and then advising, because it allows the public protector as part of his systemic investigations to do that process.
Do you see any constraints, binding constraints, be it an institutional arrangement, such as the legislation that governs the public protector, or budgetary arrangements, or allocation of resources, or anything that is extrinsic of the office that influences the ability of the office? And secondly, just if the mandate wide enough sufficient, should we be putting more teeth, for example, into the mouth of the public protector so that he or she fights more effectively? Well, what would be your take on that?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Firstly, in terms of the Act, I think it's wide enough for now. You could consider in future, for example, to include some relationship between PAJA and the public protector. At the moment, in terms of Section 6 of the Act, there is a relationship between PAJA, the Promotion of Access to Information Act, and the public protector. But I mean, public protectors, by their nature, their main job is administrative justice. It's just administrative action.
PAJA is the Promotion of Access to Justice.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you. So from one area where it looks, you probably do need to link PAJA with the public protector, because it costs a lot of money to try and enforce matters through the courts, and the public protector is free, and a whole lot of people don't know that. So it's theoretically, the moment they can actually enforce, they can base their decision on, the public protector can base its decision on PAJA, but I think you would want to tighten that. Institutional arrangements, are they constraints? I don't think there are surmountable constraints. The public protector has a budget of nearly 100,000. The last time I said it was 800 and something thousand, almost 100,000. That's a fairly, is it almost, what?
800 and something million.
No, thank you, Honourable Chair. Actually, it's 800 something million, not thousand. That's the mistake that I was making.
That's 50 billion.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. close to 100 million. I think it's close to 100 million.
So yes. It would be about 80-something million.
Yes. So I looked at that budget. I don't know at the moment how it's spent, but obviously the report talks to that. Some of the things you want to do don't cost money. In the commission, for example, before this particular commission that I'm in, a lot of our workshops involved experts for two reasons. One was financial constraints, but secondly, because we thought experts were able to talk to the issues we're dealing with. With that still small budget, we've been able to go around the country and meet ordinary people. It's still not enough because people are saying we're not reaching the villages. But I'm saying we've been able to stretch what we have to address those issues. So, of course, though, if you're going to go on an outreach to try and make sure that every South African knows that the public protector is their umbrella, you probably have to think about a budget for public awareness, about an increased budget. But my starting point would be to use this one and look at, through human contact, how much of it can take me forward, because that's what we've done with the commission. And constraints in terms of what the law allows the public protector to do, I indicated earlier that I thought that in the first 15 years of democracy, the public protector, in my view, has done well, because remember that they were in new territory. They were trying, and it was trial and error. But I think within the current act, it can still stretch more. It could do more of these own investigations and systemic solutions within this current barrier. And then you would say, what is the constraint? The constraint might be that the decision of the public protector is not binding at all. But let's test that first. Let's make those decisions. Let's go to those communities on our own before the communities go on fire and find out what the problems are. For example, Ukutwala, Eastern Cape, been a burning issue. My view was, because people are complaining that police are not doing anything, chiefs are not doing anything, it's something, again, the public protector could have gone and, or could go in the future and find out who's doing what. Because sometimes it's rumor, maybe people are not doing something wrong. But you do that investigation, you check whether the law is adequate or if human behavior, you advise the chiefs, you advise the traditional leaders and everyone and say, what are your respective roles for people? So I think those can be done within the current budget. Thank you.
Maybe just to know that the entire committee system of parliament has been surviving on the budget of a quarter of what you said, about 25 million. It might be correct. Please, Claudia.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Benson, I see that you taught at the school where I did my grade 1. So there's a lot that we share. That was my first encounter with the school. You are bringing in the other portion of work that is supposed to be done, or a function that is supposed to be performed by the public protector, that of actually initiating some kind of monitoring work insofar as the work of government is concerned to function. Do you see a role or a relationship between the public protector, the newly established Ministry of Planning and Monitoring and Evaluation, that South Africa provincial government, in an effort really to curb what we have experienced over the past 2 or 3 months, but also general dissatisfaction from from our population on service delivery, but not just on service delivery, also the administration of shelters. Because there are cases where people really feel maybe it's not a place for the public protector, but what role would the public protector have to ensure that some of the decisions that are made are in the best interest of the public?
Thank you, Honourable Member, and also thank you about the history we share. I taught there and I studied there in this book for 5 years. Thank you, ma'am. There is a role for the public protector, as I indicated, in looking at service delivery proactively and advising both government and the communities about what to do. As you're speaking, Honourable Member, I looked at one of the areas where I thought I could be wrong that the public protector has not made an impact a lot with local government, and yet the Act says at all tiers of government. And if you look at most complaints around service delivery are around local government. And where the public protector can assist is in areas around efficiency and in effectiveness, because the Act says the public protector can advise. So its role is not just to do a report and say what went wrong and who must be hit with a hammer or something like that, but I think it can also give guidelines on what needs to be done. It can also give guidelines on who needs to be trained and what kind of training needs to be done so that they can give that service. Now, I learned that also that's the role of government. That's exactly what government is supposed to do, and that's what central government at the moment is trying to do, to take ownership at all levels of government and provide guidance. So the public protector, it would be important. Chair. It would be important for the public protector, where you're entering in the arena where you're going to give guidance and where you're going to give advice, to work with other arms of government without obviously violating the idea that this is an independent institution, but we're running one country and one people. So you don't want to come up with confusing instructions where the public protector says you will do this way, and the next week someone else comes. In fact, with Ubutala, that's what they said, and everyone comes to the Eastern Cape and says, this is what's happening, this should happen, and people are getting fatigue on the basis of that. And the public protector has been there, the Human Rights Commission has been there, CTE, Justice, Presidency, sometimes together, sometimes individually. So I think if we're dealing with the community, I don't think, Honourable Members, that it would be a violation of the independence of the institution where we are dealing with proactive work and identifying the problem and suggesting ways of efficient government, responsive governance, and accountable governance, which is what this institution is supposed to provide. Obviously, when it comes to the problems where we're going to start pointing fingers, which unfortunately this institution has to do, it will have to take those decisions alone and inform the minister for planning appropriately when it finds certain public figures to blame, whether they're political or administrative. Thank you, ma'am.
I have to give this honorable, honorable Zelda, are you done? Are you done? All right. I had skipped Honourable Spagnoni earlier on, as Honourable Jumper, because I'm at the end. All right. Thank you, Chairperson. I don't mind you for the compliment because I shouted no, and I'm really asking whether there are any questions. Maybe let me start by also declaring that I happen to know Ms. Madonsela from the NGO world. I was working at NUPILA, and she used to do work starting with person for our organization. But also to say, you didn't mention some of the work you've been doing. I've been listening to your show on the radio, the Kwala Kwala and the Kwekwe FM, and I've also shared
a program with you in the Gwalagwala FM. Specifically on that, what do you think will be the role of the radio in educating people about the public protector?
Honorable Spagnone has a passion for radio. That's a medium of
communication. Thank you. Thank you. Honourable Chair, and thank you, Honourable Sibanyan. On the matter that the Honourable Member has mentioned, we were dealing with the recognition of customer relationships as educating members of the public and then letting them ask questions. Again, based on that, sometimes they would raise questions that require us to go to appropriate institutions like pension funds that are not giving them their money, etc., home affairs, etc., and then assist them. But all of it's done, you know, telephonically and by the radio. The question is, the radio is very important. In fact, there are people who just never watch TV. They just listen to the radio all the time. And I think we could put a lot of resources there. I think the Department of Justice, the program that I was part of was a partnership between the Center for Reconciliation and Equality Studies and the Department of Justice. They were doing the act in 12 official languages. And once you're talking to people about the Recognition of Customer Emergencies Act, people ask about every area of the law. Because they're just hungry for that information. But most instances, they have a case. They already have a case in the house that needs to be dealt with. So in short, Honourable Member, I think radio would have to be the anchor for the average person. Because even the elite, they also listen to the radio. When people are driving, they listen to Metro, they listen to SAFM, etc. So literally everyone, or most people in society, to be listening to the radio. So it's worth investing there on everything about the public protector, what it does, but also about the laws, the laws that govern public administration, like PAJA, PAYA, Equality Act, a whole lot of the laws that impact on service delivery in the public sector.
Yes, question, last one. I see you've got a wealth of experience on advocacy, in law, etc. How would you respond if a person says, but if you look at your practice of law, it seems it doesn't match your advocacy in law? Would you see that as a disadvantage in the position for which you have been nominated?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I think that would be, I would expect that criticism, but I would say it is not necessarily a valid criticism. My practice of law has been over the years. I think what people would say is court work, going to court. But interpreting the law, receiving problems, going through institutions, I could even fight the institutions I've worked with and sorted the problem around law, around immigration, administrative justice, labor matters. So I have been dealing with the law ever since I left university, Honorable Member. Yes, litigation, I'll be honest, Honorable Member, I have limited litigation experience. I did a bit of litigation when I was in the trade union movement, when I was at Verse. Firstly, as a student, I did litigation for a year as a, what we call practical legal studies. And then later, when I was based at Cal, Philippa Kruger, who works at Verse, who was running the law clinic, she was. Like when I was now working at Cal, she used to involve me in certain cases, and she could confirm that. She used to involve me in, you know, gender, human rights, and equality kind of cases. And then now with Fowler, part of our work involves pro bono. I don't go to court, but I work with the team in Fowler that discusses this case. We've had a lot on recognition of customer remunerations.
clarify there that the Act clearly recognizes the four areas of competence as possible sources of expertise to fill the position. Either you must have been a judge, or you must have practiced as an attorney or an advocate. Our interpretation is a narrow one to refer to actually doing litigation in court, doing running a practice. But those are not the only criteria. The other criterion, of course, is having been an academic, as well as the criterion of having had experience of public administration. And finally, somebody who's been a member of parliament. It goes on to say any combination of those up to a minimum of 10 years. So we as a committee wouldn't necessarily regard actual practice in a narrower sense of the word as the only, the be it all and end it all in terms of the criteria, because we would be violating. Any of those areas of experience. All right. Honorable Spanini, do you have any further questions? Okay. Colleagues, any other questions? All right. I always struggle with blankets because I have a huge voice, so I very difficult to cover. there have been issues which I think you've addressed fairly well around the constraints, institutional constraints which I have in the beginning. But there is the issue about whether the mouth of the public protector has enough teeth to bite. In terms of the impact that its work could have in changing people's circumstances. Somebody comes to you, lodges a complaint, then you write a report. Now, if the department ignores the report, what then? Right. Now, obviously, there is a Professor Kadaat's small report. I'm not sure what the recommendations are. And obviously this committee, not its job to actually recommend institutional reform in the office or any other office. But if you were to be asked a question, do you feel that the competence is the legal competence of this office are sufficient for the name to fit the name public? Is the public protector having enough muscle to protect the public? What would your recommendation be?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I would say that the only concern we might have is that it does not have a binding decision. The report is a report and is not an order of court. But before I talk to what could be recommended going forward, Honorable Chairperson, I would like to indicate that there are more powers other than writing the report, and those are the ones that I thought the public protector could exploit more, such as conciliation. Conciliation and mediation could result in an agreement that can be made an order of court. So that's an area we have to explore, which means obviously a lot more of field work. Instead of being in the office and just requesting, you know, explanations from people, you really have a meeting between the person complaining or the person who's a whistleblower. It could be a complainant, it could just be a whistleblower, which is there's a problem. Then you go on site and you deal with that. And if there's two people involved, we go for conciliation, and then that could be made an order of court. We could also negotiate. I think when you introduce more of those powers of negotiation, and I've seen those powers the public protector has used, because in that 10-year report, they do talk about they often negotiate, and then they've attached questions. I mean, some of the letters where people are thanking them for negotiating a settlement for that. So in that particular case, it's right. Some of the powers have been explored. Do we need a public protector that makes binding decisions? I don't want to immediately say yes. Honorable Chairperson, because I think maybe because of my law reform background as well, you need to look at what institutions do we have already in the country and how much do you want to fragment the administration of justice? How much more? Obviously, because a lot of the complaints are civil, maybe you could allow the public protector to act as a tribunal as well. But it's not something I have thought through completely and said you want to give it those powers. Because if you're going to give it those powers, then you also have to look at the independence and the full independence of not just the public protector, the investigators in the public protector, because they will now just be investigating. They will now be making decisions. So, but I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying we have to think it through and say we don't, you know.
You see that decision become reviewable.
Yes.
And to what extent should that compromise their constitution?
Yes.
These are the other tribunals, for example, they are purely quasi judicial law and therefore their status.
But having said that, Honorable Chair, it's still a law reform question. I think it's not something I can say yes or no now. It's something I can say maybe let's review, let's look at it, maybe throw it at the Law Reform Commission and to look at other countries and look at the cause. This is the cause of giving us more powers. As you rightly point out that when you become a tribunal, then you become a junior tribunal.
All right, just in conclusion, assuming that members have no further questions, what questions would you have for the committee, any or any final remarks or comments to the committee?
In terms of the final remarks, first, Honorable Chair, I would like to make those first. To say, I must say that I never imagined that I would be sitting here and talking to this committee about applying for the position of public protector. But when one of the women's organizations approached me about it, I reflected on it and it took me 30 minutes to say yes. And yet it's not something that I would thinking about, but that's the next phase of my life. But having reflected on it, I really think that if given an opportunity, I could make a difference. I think in the first 15 years of democracy, the public protector has done a fair amount of good work. I mean, they have been mistakes. Here and there, there's been complaints from Transparency, Integrity International, that sometimes it hasn't explored all its powers and stretched itself to deal with the problems. And one of the cases where that is reflected is the controversial mail in banning case. So for me, what I would want to do is for the public protector to going forward, it's done its best now, but to be more thorough and more visible to people, so that even if it makes a decision that people don't like, it is a decision that can be defended on law and on fact. And obviously, courts can always make a decision that contradicts yours. That's why you have an appeal system. So if they decide against it, doesn't mean you were necessarily you didn't do the right work. It just means somebody else has a different decision. But I would like to introduce something more thorough. I would also want, honestly, to see a public protector finding every clinic in the townships, in the rural areas, everywhere where there is a civil servant or where there is public work going on. I would like, whether it's even in the border post, we've had foreign affairs, you know, when they talk about how they treat those women in the borders that are trading across countries. We would want to see a sign that says the public protector, but also with something then that says for what, you can have to approach it for this thing. So, Chair System, I'm really grateful for this opportunity, and if I am able to, if you do have faith in me, government has faith in me, I think I can make a difference. I would like to see the public protector to do the little cases, but in the big cases as well. At the moment, I think the focus has been on the big cases. And I would like to strike a balance between the big cases and the little person. Okay. For my own questions, it would be, how long will this process take? When will I be informed about the decision? Because I work in the South African Law Reform Commission as a full-time commissioner, so I would need to know when is this decision likely to be taken?
The commission will decide tomorrow afternoon, and its decision its recommendation would serve before the House on Thursday afternoon. And if the House approves the recommendation of the House, it then would be forwarded to the President soon thereafter. I have no control there. But the ideal is if the appointment is made at the beginning of October, because the current public protector tenure expires on the 15th day of October, and you would want them to have a handover period, in other words, an overlap between the incoming and the outgoing, so that there is in the future there will be a limit down. Now, doctor dies, he must have transferred all the wisdom to leave the bones to somebody else so that they don't go with the institutional memory. It's really then up to the president when he's ready to make an appointment. Hopefully, by that date. But obviously, that would be out of the hands of Parliament. That's the best time that I can offer of any help. Yeah. All right. If that's all the questions you wanted to ask, we would like to thank you for indulging us. We know we have forced the situation where you have to sleep over in Cape Town, and hopefully you'd find it comfortable to end your in your heart to forgive us for inconvenience in that way. But we wish you all the best. There is a single lunch here. Yeah, I wouldn't want to stay sitting at dinner to stay cold, and some of you felt you want.
wanted to stretch your legs. Can I just finish? Can I just finish and then we can interject? The last candidate, I understand, has also had to give in to the reality that she would have to sleep over. I would suggest that we do have that short break that you asked for. Just grab our food, maybe 5-10 minutes, and then we proceed to give the last candidate. All right. Yes, in fact, both of them. Oh, you mean her? Oh, is she gone now? Oh, sorry. No, I'm sure we. But she'll probably eat better food at the hotel than the single lunch that you're going to have. All the tape of a palate.
Hello. Hello. Hello.
Hello. You want us men to? You want this man to?
Thank you.
I'll do that. Where's the plate?
Oh, the plate of this.
Now let me tell you, two people, each before they died, the one was 3 days before she died, and one of them was old, 2 weeks before she died. But I realized that that was too much to take. And I couldn't say no to them, neither could I lie and promise them something. You know, you don't like your dying. You can only cut yourself. So I said, I'll think about it. So some 3 days after, I promised to think about it. So, so when I went to Rome, and there was the Pope ordaining Cardinal Messia, based in Germany.
Yeah.
It has the Catholic Institute of Education. And I'm
Advocate Mboku, welcome to the ad hoc committee. I would love on behalf of the committee first to thank you for indulging us by coming forward as one of the eight candidates that the people in front of you agreed to shortlist as the best candidate that has come forward. And I wish you success in the next stage, which is to eventually decide on the one in which you become a new
society, never I thought of ourselves. So many challenges. All right. Let's proceed. I am going to ask you one or two questions, and then I'll leave it to the members to take it from there. The first question that I'd like to ask you is, well, obviously the members must have something in your CV that inspired them to invite you here. It is not an accident. From your point of view, what is it that you would say that is are the strengths, the qualities that qualify you above the rest as the ideal candidate for the position of public protector?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The strength which I think qualified me more than my peers for this position are the following. I have worked as a prosecutor for 6 years, worked as a magistrate in the district court for 8 years, and I'm now in the regional court and have been serving as a magistrate from 2002 to now. I impartiality via my deliberate, because ever since I sat on the bench, both in the district and the regional court, I have been handling cases, sometimes high profile cases, and I'm not afraid to take decisions. I've taken decisions which are unpopular, but because I had to take those decisions, I did take those decisions. I lectured on a part-time basis for 10 years, from 1991 to 2001, in the field of administrative law and interpretation of statutes. And in regard to the changes of our constitution, I think I have benefited because I improved myself right from the junior degree to the position that I am today. And I'm able to grasp the constitution and how one should implement whatever laws that have come after this 93 as well as the 96 constitution. I'm very independent. I mean independent in terms of thinking, because my work as a prosecutor, both as a control prosecutor, as a magistrate, as well as a regional magistrate, requires independence from me. And I have, during that time, acted in a very independent, non-biased way in giving all the decisions that I give. And to show for this, I worked in the child rape court. And before, we were granted powers to impose or pass life sentences. All our cases had to go to the High Court, so that the High Court should confirm whether we acted in accordance with justice. And I find that 98% of the cases that were sent to the High Court by myself were found to be in accordance with justice. I am also in the Council for Correctional Services, which sits at least four times a year, but we seek more time to consider sometimes very high-profile serious cases, to advise the Minister of Correctional Services about who should be released and who should not be released. And I think one keeps independence in making such decisions. The Office of the Public Protector is a very independent office, and one has to be an independent thinker to be able to work in this office, because everything starts and ends with the public protector. And for one to give decisions or to make decisions, make which are independent without fear or failure, they should have a strong personality like the one here, because I operate without fear or favor.
going to tell me all what I can say for now.
Forgive our rude behavior of continuing with our dinner whilst we're doing this work. It's just that we're trying to minimize the damage that's already been done in terms of the loss of time. Thank you for forgiving us. Is there anything that you know of which you think, if it was brought to the attention of the committee, might pose some reservations or doubts about appointing you? And if so, how would you respond to that? How would you explain yourself around that?
Up to now, Honorable Chair, I have nothing that would cause this body or doesn't cast doubt on this body in terms of appointing me as a public protector. Not unless there's anything that anybody knows of and would bring to my attention.
As regards your personality as an individual, your nature, your temperament, the way in which you relate to people, be they colleagues, be they clients or customers of the services you provide, short-temperedness, or gentleness, or whatever it is. But what can you tell us about that?
I am a very reserved person. In that I like to keep to myself, although I do socialize now and again and meet with other people. My temperament is just like any other person's. And I act in a controllable fashion. Whatever situation comes my way, I think I am able to control myself and act accordingly. And I relate okay with colleagues and people close to me. It depends on the kind of relationship that I have with the different people that I meet along the way.
Yes, obviously you wouldn't be nice to somebody who is ill-mannered the way they relate to others. Colleagues, let me start with Honorable Ramudi.
Thank you, Chair. Advocate. What is it that you can join us with the public protector, having been there, having seen what has been happening in the office? Your view on the weakness and the strength of that office. Is there anything that you can tell us?
I think the current incumbent, the person who's holding the office of the public protector now, has given it a bit of a face, because the initial one really didn't do much to advertise that office because it was not too known. Even currently, it is not too known, but at least something has been done by the current incumbent to let the office be known. I've seen and heard of a few reports by the Office of the Public Protector, and I have my reservations about the decisions that were given sometimes. Maybe I would have taken a different decision, but in terms of marketability, I think a great deal of improvement has been done compared to the first time visiting myself here. And I've seen in some of their documents that they take them about 8 months to make a report or to make findings in respect of a complaint. And in my
my view, I think 8 months is too much. This is a weakness. I work in the child rape court, and I give my judgment very speedily because the ordinary man in the street is not keen on your delay. They want you to investigate the matter and deal with it as speedily as you can. And I think my view is that 8 months is too long to wait for a decision or a direction. And I don't know how they evaluate and monitor the functions of the government. But if I were to be appointed, I think I would put in place mechanisms to improve the monitoring and the reporting. And that's basically all I can tell you.
Honorable Ndapane, please proceed.
Advocate Bofu, you have happily covered my question. But you have actually, I was to ask you, what shortcomings have you noticed in the present office of the Prophet? So you have mentioned them. But what I want to find out from you now, what strategies do you think you may apply to address the shortcomings of that office so that can perform this duty up to the standard?
Yes, as I say, the current incumbent has gone a long way in trying to address the problems of the initial public protector, because nothing much happened with the initial public protector. But this one has also got strategic planning in place for running that department or that institution in a corporate way. This is exactly what I would improve on. I would bring the culture of dealing with complaints, as I said, in a very speedy way and in a very efficient way. And I would put in place monitoring and evaluation processes to see if this office is working. And to rub in its relevance, because its relevance should be rubbed in on the basis that it is a Chapter 9 institution that should enhance our democracy. And if nothing has been done from the beginning when it was installed in 1994 up to this level, I do not think much has been done. I would, especially in the little known areas, I have listed all the areas in South Africa, as you can see on my CV, in the shack areas, in the townships, in the affluent suburbs and all over, and I know what the needs of the people in those places are. I know what areas need to be informed about the Office of Public Defender. It is your most rural, your most in the shacks, in the townships, people don't know about this institution. You're talking Greek when you tell them about the public protector. And they're the ones who really need the services. So I would find it in need to organize that those people know about the Office of the Public Protector. Because it's useless to have such an office, and people are not even aware of its existence.
Honorable Japan, you're covered. Okay, Honorable Spagnoli.
Thank you. Advocate Mpofu, I see you have attended this program, the Judicial Skills Training Program, in fact, on two occasions. I just want to find out, have you ever had an acting stint?
I've never had an acting stint. Unfortunately, the judge presidents choose who they want to come and act, and unfortunately, I was not among them.
Maybe a follow-up to that question. You are currently a regional court magistrate.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank
if I may just ask a follow-up to that. I served in the Magistrates Commission, and therefore our job is to look for new magistrates, filling vacancies. Now you want to deplete the pool of magistrates by moving to the public protector position. Don't you think that would actually be compromising our target of wanting to transform the judiciary to make it more gender representative, especially given the fact that, well, I regret you have not been appointed, but who knows, maybe in the future, God willing, you might just become a judge, given your experience as a presiding officer. Don't you think that you'd be better off there?
I have maybe wrongly so come to realize that magistrates are not the most preferred for the bench, because the judges argue that we don't do civil work. Which fact I don't quite agree with, because I'm studying currently. And you will, as a lawyer, know, Advocate Masuta, that during the process of researching, that you're learning. And I mean, if you go through your LLB, through your master's, and ultimately through your doctorate, studying, what's the difference between you and the person who's in the Johannesburg bar?
In case we're bringing the civil jurisdiction to you people,
yes, I think there is still that attitude that the magistrate shouldn't come to the bench because of the reasons that I mentioned now, although I don't quite agree with the reasons. And the civil jurisdiction is brought to the regional court, it will make any difference or not, because the way of giving acting appointments and inviting people to act is quite, I'm looking for the way, not so clear cut yet. You are not sure whether you can go and act or not. Besides, I've been a prosecutor and a magistrate, it's now 21 years, and I'd like to see a change of scenario. And I think I'll also be contributing, by the way, if I get appointed as a public protector. And nothing prevents me from leaving that post and getting on the bench.
Of course. But maybe you may want, in relation to that concern, the right to the church as one of the JSC, the chief justice. I've served on the JSC for the last parliament for 5 years, and there's definitely room to entertain complaints, because that can only improve our system of administration of justice. But let me allow our other colleagues to ask. I had Honorable Giorgio, and then I'll come to Honorable George. Honorable Giorgio?
The problem with sitting with lawyers in the room is that they end up reviewing the justice system. May I ask that you go back to what it is that we are about today? Jefferson, thank you very much. Advocate Mpofu, what do you understand the role of the public protector to be? In your own words, what would you understand it to be? But also a follow-up on that, you had said earlier on that a lot of people don't know about the public protector. What practical work or what practical steps would you take to ensure that it gets publicized and more people do actually know what it is that they do and how they can access it?
Yeah. The role of the public protector, the way I understand it, is to correct or to deal with complaints that people bring whenever there's delays by the state, a state service, a particular state service in rendering a service, or if there's any impropriety in terms of dealing with whatever the public service should be dealing with. And it is not very acceptable, as I indicated earlier, to the ordinary man in this country. And to make it acceptable, I would really publicize it. Because I, you know, when I came, told my colleagues I'm coming to this interview last week, one of the regional court magistrates didn't even know what a public protector was. And he was saying, don't apply for those schools because you're going to lose benefits or whatever. And it shocked me because you understand the regional magistrate not knowing. So what about the men in the street? I would use the justice center because I don't only do my work as a public servant, go to work and come back. I was instrumental, for example, in arranging a meeting between correctional services and the magistrate, the council for correctional services, to talk about the issue of overcrowding. So the same way that I deal with this issue is the same way that I go out to the public. The one-stop center has been established in many, many towns, and I think those are the areas where you reach out pamphlets and let the public be aware. Go on radio, go on TV, let the public be aware of this service and let them use it.
I had another hand there. That was, yes, Honorable George.
Well, now I want to get an increase. Advocate Mpofu, what is your view on the independence of the office of the public protector? I mean, you seem to have already looked at it, should have been probably observing it, you even said, not to the right enough. What is your view of its independence? And do you think that it is independent enough? If not, what do you think you can do if you believe that it is not independent enough? If you believe it's independent enough, what is it that you think should be done to strengthen it?
My view of independence, as I say, I've been in this scenario, of course, for quite a while, where we have the independence, is that the office is independent, but not completely. It depends on the government for funding. And that can be a bit of a problem because people have to give decisions and to make decisions rather, and if they have to get their funding from the government, then it means that there is, although one can pretend that it does not exist, but surely there is a way in which getting control from the government. Your independence is sort of compromised. It's not complete. And this takes us back now to what they call the Paris Principles, where it is a well-known phenomenon that worldwide human rights have to be respected. Funding comes from different bodies outside, and I think such bodies, my view is that such bodies should be run through funding coming from outside coffers and not the state coffers, so that your control is completely untainted.
The outside, what do you refer to? Are you referring outside of government, outside of the country, or
outside of the country, outside of government?
But my next question then is to follow that route.
You know, sometimes this is a chapter 9 execution. If now it's funded outside the government, outside the country, normally
those funds sometimes they run dry. Would you like a situation where, for some reason, because you have no funding?
I'm not from
you have no funding from whatever outside. Then you the risk the public protector say it cannot operate this year because it did not get funded. That's number one. Number two, do you think that to deal with this issue of funding, besides it depends on the government for compromising its independence. Do you think that this is the only thing to address that is that it's getting outside funding?
Not necessarily. I'm just thinking that the independence can be compromised by the fact that funding comes from the government. But I'm not proposing a scenario where you get complete outside funding to an extent that the body collapses because there are no funds. What I'm really saying is trying to answer your question of the independence. I'm a bit worried because, you know, the funding comes from the government. And therefore, you have to have a person with character, a public protector with character who stands his ground, whether the money comes from the government or not, and be able to act decisively. This is basically what I'm trying to drive across.
Honorable Church.
No, I think you have answered my question.
You're comfortable.
That is not only me funding from outside. Mm-hmm. That is why we are interviewing you. Mm-hmm. We need a person of that character.
But I would have asked conversely that isn't there a risk of funding coming from outside of compromising the independence? Whoever then funds from outside may have an influence in the kind of approach that the public protector takes.
May I have a follow-up question to your question?
All right, yes. In fact, you can somehow proceed with your line of questions because you are the next person to ask questions. Let's say the other country is a donor to the public protector, and at the end of the day, they have their own views of how the public protector should work. I'm talking now the funding from outside, not from the government side. Now, those people sometimes. There is a saying that says a person who has the who holds the purse has the Bible. The person who has the money dictates what should be done and so on. Now, won't you think that will compromise the position of your independence, firstly, and secondly, as a chapter 9 institution within the government itself? Let's say the money is coming from outside now. I'm not talking about inside the country, but outside the country. That's the first question. The second question is that there are decisions that the public protector takes. There are good ones. There are absolutely bad ones. Do you think you will be able to stomach, if I say stomach, hold on, hold your food, stand tall on them? It doesn't matter where they are, because you believe they are correct, as far as you know. It doesn't chop and change. In other words, you don't say something else today as a decision, and tomorrow you see a small line within that statement that you issued yesterday, which you say you were meaning these instead of that. Chop and change within the decision itself, because that can compromise again the decision that you are taking. So lastly, as a person who has been practicing law as a magistrate, there is this thing
according to the constitution, confidentiality in everything that you do.
Confidentiality.
Yes, confidentiality. Everything that you do. A person visits you, the Honorable Chairperson visits you. He knows that there is a case that is coming to you privately and so on. I'm using the Chairperson as an example. He knows that there's a complaint that is coming to you. But he's asking you to take you out for lunch or dinner or whatever to talk about the case and so on and so forth. And immediately, in a very cordial atmosphere, they talk about the case and so on and so forth. Would you think that is compromising the confidentiality or not? How did you take that if a person put you in charge of that? Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you to you, Mr. Chair. On the question of funding from outside, as I said earlier, it nearly came out, you know, during the discussion that the real independence would be if funding doesn't come from particular source. But on the other hand, the character of the person that will be holding that office will determine everything at the end. You must have a strong character. And as a magistrate, that's one of your attributes, because you may meet Mr. Chair if he invites you, but discussing the case would be out of the question, because then it means that you're not the strong character that we expect. By dealing with those issues during the lunch, outing, or whatever, and it all comes boils down to the same question of character. The character of the person that you're going to employ as a public protector must be one that determines the office. At the end of the day, you must give it a face. You must give the institution direction, and the way you do that must be solved.
As lawyers, you have invited each other in court, and after court you go and have lunch together.
Yes.
All right. Colleagues, is that the end of questions on this one?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you very much. Advocate Mpofu, what remains for me is to ask you if there's any question whatsoever or any comments in close that you would want to put to the committee?
Well, I have nothing to say except to say that I'm quite humbled, honestly, for the recognition. The fact that one has been shortlisted is quite a milestone, and I feel humbled, and I'd like to thank every single one of you for being given this opportunity to come and present my story. Thank you.
All right, what remains for me is to wish you luck in this regard. You are excellent. All right, colleagues. That concludes our day one, a marathon as you can see. Hopefully tomorrow will not be as hectic. Are there any comments, any questions anybody wants to ask? We are meeting, resuming, I think tomorrow 9 o'clock, is that what you know to say?
Yes.
And what is the venue? Yeah. Is it
M201.
M201. Yeah. All right. Honorable Michael, you want to say something?
Thanks, Chair. You know, I just wanted to say how impressed I was with the level of questioning of this committee. You know, you would have actually thought that we'd all come together before the time and discussed what kind of questions we were going to ask, which didn't happen. And I'm just very impressed with the level of interviewing skills that this committee has.
Obviously, this is one individual who represents an entire institution. So you want the best possible candidate.
But let's see the rest of them tomorrow, and then let's see how at the end of the day we feel about them and to entrust them. All right, the meeting adjourns at this point. I assume all travel arrangements have been made with anybody who needs transport. And see you tomorrow.
Thank you, Chairman. Spagnoli has a car. No problem.
Right, it's crazy. Look at this.